My name is Michael McCusker. Before anything, I'd like to wish a happy birthday to my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, Josephine Gendusa Campashani, who would be 119 years old today. She was born in 1891, a half century before I was born in 1941, and she lived to the age of 93. All her children died in their 90s, my mother among them. So happy birthday, grandmother. She's one of the few, I suppose, that one would wish that the religion she believed in could come through and provide her with an afterlife, a good one. There are some others I wish would have an afterlife, but in the other place. Well, I am considerably pleased that the Clatsop County Commission will soon include three new members who might be regarded as progressives in their political philosophies. It probably comes as a shock that the electorate usually turns rightward in hard times in favor of those who most often cause the problems to begin with. But not this time, and not here. I remember when Peter Huttula ran for the Port Commission a few years back, amidst the initial shock and awe of LNG being foisted upon the public with little notice or opportunity for any of us to have anything to say about it. He could have won if he had campaigned on his own, but he pitched his fate with two other LNG opponents in an attempt to help their campaigns, and lost with them. At the time, LNG proponents claimed the re-election of incumbent port commissioners responsible for the LNG fiasco was a referendum in support of LNG, and not a sympathy vote for the dunderheads personally. If that were indeed true, Tuesday's elections certainly indicate just how much the ground has shifted. I might suggest that the three new commissioners-elect keep a wary eye on the incumbents while they train for their new positions on the county commission the many long months before they are seated early next year. Well, we still have the problem of Walmart, although we still have the problem of LNG, the original culprit, Calpine / Oregon LNG, that caused this mess to begin with. But looming also is Walmart. And I would like to read something that Ted Thomas of Astoria wrote about the, quote, impact of Walmart, unquote, which is the title of what he wrote. Impressed by the efficiency of the Autobahn that he encountered while directing the Allied invasion of Germany during World War II, former U.S. Army General Dwight Eisenhower assumed the office of the presidency of the United States in 1953. With the patronage of his political backers of automakers, oil and chemical corporations, and tire companies, he launched the largest construction project in human history, the Dwight David Eisenhower National System of Interstate and Defense Highways, commonly called the Interstate Highway System, or simply the Interstate. Eisenhower raised $130 billion through higher taxes on gasoline, the federal general fund, and from state general funds to construct the 46,876 miles of interstate roadway. This took place concurrently with the criminal conspiracy of Standard Oil of California, Mack, Firestone, General Motors, and others colluding to form holding companies in order to purchase and destroy 45 municipal transit systems throughout the country. Along with government underwriting of the mortgage banking system through the federally funded mortgage credit entities of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, these subsidies drove the housing boom of the 1950s. Commercial property like shopping centers that followed the land grab in the suburbs were facing bankruptcy and appealed to the government to pass a change in 1954 to the U.S. tax code that allowed acceleration and front-loading of the depreciation allowance on commercial properties. This one move made shopping centers into incredible tax shelters by allowing owners of newly constructed shopping centers and, later, big box stores, to declare huge losses and so defray a greater part of their tax liability than any legitimately, and that's in quotes, established store could dream of. For example, in 1960, the Kratter Corporation took in about $10 million in gross revenue from its commercial properties while only having expenses of $4.8 million. But because of accelerated depreciation of $6.9 million, they claimed a paper loss of $1.7 million. Kratter's investors not only had millions of dollars in tax-free income, but were allowed to actually defray the profits they made from other investments. It was a tax racket, far more lucrative than meager stock dividends. As developers built new shopping centers, they took the big deductions allowed in the first 7 to 14 years, then unloaded them on some naive Johnny-come-lately, moving on to build newer and bigger malls that would put the old wounded ducks out of business. Walmart alone now holds more than 300 empty and abandoned buildings. This is why in 1953 there were only 6 million square feet of retail space constructed in the United States and over 30 million square feet built in 1956. By 1973, over 18,000 shopping centers had been constructed since 1954, almost 20 per state every year. No wonder the post-war boom made Americans feel they were rich. It looked like prosperity, so people assumed they must be able to afford the contents of those new shopping centers. But the reality was that retail space was being built exceedingly beyond proportion to the actual demand for it. This was not enough. Developers soon asked for more and got it. Urban renewal zones froze the tax rate paid at pre-development valuation. Special economic zones also eroded the ability of local governments to collect their fair share from those corporations for schools, roads, police, fire departments, and water services. The proposed Walmart site in Warrenton is inside the urban renewal zone, even though it is delineated as high-value wetland, requiring mitigation. But wait, there is more. Driven by the false belief in the benefits of big box retailers, local elected officials nationwide have actively underwritten their proliferation. In the 1990s, cities began funneling billions of dollars in development subsidies to big retailers. Walmart reaped more than $1 billion in local and state subsidies. And need it be mentioned that many states have provisions in their tax codes that virtually allow corporations to avoid paying any income tax at all. Oregonians are certainly familiar with the state's egregious corporate minimum tax that was the subject of a recent ballot measure. Of course, small, established, independent stores receive none of these benefits, and the like most ordinary citizens are obliged to pay their unfair tax burdens that multiply in the face of corporate giveaways. The tax benefits given to the super-rich lift the burden of paying for civil services from those who caused the demand for them and have the means to pay, to those over-taxed to pay for problems they did not create. In essence, ordinary Americans are paying taxes at ever-increasing rates that contribute to the profits of, for example, Walmart shareholders. On January 29th of this year, Warrenton Mayor Gil Gramson asked State Senator Betsy Johnson to overturn tax legislation in order to allow the city to set higher rates. This after concealing a 3% increase in city water rates. Few of the new mega retail centers would be possible without the massive tax breaks and subsidies given to them. Given that established and small-scale retail stores cannot obtain the level of subsidies or tax advantages from the various levels of government, they are at an unfair disadvantage to the unfairly advantaged big box stores. Imagine the implications for the tax structure today if all of these costs were removed and retailers developed organically, and that's in quotes, in accordance to the fair taxation rate that everyone else is compelled to pay. Based upon the proposed size and the track record developed in other states, the entry of Walmart into Clatsop County will probably precipitate the following economic outcomes. In the few years that Walmart was expanding the fastest in Iowa, that state lost 555 grocery stores, 298 hardware stores, 293 building supply stores, 161 variety shops, 158 women's clothing stores, and 116 pharmacies. Studies show that for an anticipated 300 Walmart jobs, and that's in quotes, 420 people currently employed in retail and other corollary occupations will eventually lose their jobs due to business closures, bankruptcy, and layoffs due to downsizing. Many more who will be able to keep their businesses and jobs will only do so at substantial losses in income and pay cuts due to the market capture by Walmart of between 40% and 80%. Independent stores will be forced to cut wages and benefits, reduce service and selection, and move their locations. Many of those who don't make it will suffer personal bankruptcy, foreclosure, and family dissolution. Of the 300 anticipated associates, that also in quotes, employed by the proposed Walmart, fully 100 will not be full-time, defined by Walmart as only 28 hours a week. These people will not be eligible to purchase Walmart's health or medical insurance. Another 100 will not be able to afford it. When they or a member of their family becomes sick or is injured, they will wind up at the emergency room of a local hospital with acute symptoms without the ability to pay for treatment, waiting, or more accurately, being compelled to wait until symptoms become acute greatly multiplies the cost of treatment. The cost of providing care to them will be passed on to others as the rates charged for treatment of that can pay will be increased to pay the costs. Walmart has directed its underpaid employees to apply for social welfare programs, such as they are. Many will qualify for food stamps and frequent food banks. Most of them will not be able to afford to rent, let alone buy, a house. Many will qualify for scant and mismanaged Section 8 housing assistance. All of these demands upon federal, state, county, and local systems will raise the tax burden of the subsequently diminished tax base. Local taxpayers will pay for the sheriff to evict the victims of Walmart's predatory practices. And of course, those driven to despair out of want are more likely to self-medicate themselves through drug and alcohol abuse, and tend toward deterioration and violence in their lives. Again, this is recognizable as taxes that subsidize Walmart dividends. Supporters of the proposed Walmart, Warrenton Walmart, have frequently expressed their subscription to the idea that the benefits of Walmart will outweigh the cost to the community. That somehow the perception alone of low prices will draw more people to the local area and so recapture consumers' spending that is otherwise lost to Longview or Portland. This idea suffers a basic structural flaw. In every study of the actual effects of a Walmart being constructed in a community, poverty levels have significantly increased, especially among children. University of Pennsylvania researchers concluded that counties with a Walmart store have grown poorer than surrounding counties, and the more Walmarts in a county, the faster its decline into deeper poverty. Capitalized from far away and managed exclusively for the benefit of shareholders, Walmart donates substantially less to charities and community organizations per dollar of income. Walmart management cares little for the local quality of life and seldom avails itself of the facts of the privation caused by the presence of a Walmart in a community, let alone do anything to mitigate it. Unlike locally owned and independent businesses that buy and bank locally, every Walmart store's daily receipts are wired to Walmart headquarters in Bentonville. The location for the proposed Walmart in Warrenton is on a piece of high-value wetland. As the projected acquisition in lieu of mitigation, and that's a quote, will amount to a net loss of wetlands, the impact on the environment will be negative. Wetlands perform valuable and essential functions like floodwater storage and water purification. Large-scale parking lots and warehouse roofing are impermeable surfaces and have no value as wetlands. Without tree cover, sunlight penetrates and warms the water, promoting growth of algae and thermal stress that will adversely affect dissolved oxygen content far downstream, making waterways a hostile environment for juvenile fish and other aquatic life. Fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides, and chemical runoff from storage and other activities have been serious problems at other Walmart stores in the past and can easily be a problem here also. The replacement of this wetland with a Walmart will increase flooding and diminish water quality. In the local spruce wetland, there are hundreds of species of vegetation, birds, mammals, and amphibians, such as the at-risk red-legged frog. Many are indicator species of the overall health of a wetland ecosystem. By building upon great blocks of wetlands, the connectivity necessary for the health of many species is lost. The breaking up of many wildlife corridors into dead ends will adversely impact many creatures as elk and deer that will find their traditional migratory routes blocked. Traffic studies show that a Walmart of the proposed scale in Warrenton can be expected to incur an additional 7,500 car trips a day. This will impact the air quality and contribute to oily waste runoff. Many of the targeted customer base will be coming from across the Astoria Bridge and from Astoria to the bottleneck at the Young's Bay Bridge, greatly compounding traffic congestion. It has recently been revealed that road development near the new Costco has been engineered specifically to fulfill the role as terminus of a bypass from Highway 30 at John Day, somehow over the Young's River Bridge to Costco's front door in the North Coast Business Park in Warrenton. This was paid for largely without public awareness or consent. The Warrenton City Council has also publicly appealed for state financing for the bypass and went so far as to say it was willing to construct the bypass on their own, one piece at a time if necessary, unquote. Such a bypass will most likely turn Astoria into a ghost town. This is just the beginning of the cost our community is being stuck with in order to make big box shareholders richer. And that was The Cost of Walmart by Ted Thomas. Well, possibly most of you by now are aware that 2 days ago was the 30th anniversary of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. I'd like to read something that I wrote as a preface to something else. The prettiest mountain. The way popular history has of getting things confused, it will probably be common knowledge in a few years that Harry Truman, who was once President of the United States, died in the spectacular explosion of Mount St. Helens on May 18, 1980. At least 60 people died in that blast, which had the fury of several nuclear bombs. Thousands of animals were killed. The entire forests were obliterated. Spirit Lake disappeared. Mudslides and log jams flooded the Toutle River and knocked out several bridges. The Columbia River Channel had to be dredged because mud washed downriver, blocked ships. Eastern Washington was covered with volcanic ash as far away as Spokane. It was estimated that millions of tons of dust were released into the atmosphere, which it was thought would form a ring around Earth and reduce sunlight. Oregon poet Walt Curtis suggested that the eruption be regarded as an example of nuclear destruction. He wrote, quote, that thousands of St. Helens-like eruptions will happen if we do not make a concerted and conscientious effort to bring about nuclear disarmament, unquote. Mount St. Helens was the prettiest mountain in the Pacific Northwest. Its shape was almost a perfect cone like Japan's Fuji and was usually wrapped in snow. The first eruption was in late March 1980, and the cataclysmic blast was on May 18th. Harry Truman, who was not president, became an authentic folk hero when he refused to leave the mountain which had been his home for half a century. He might not have thought he would die, but that is incidental to legend. He will be remembered, eternally linked with Mount St. Helens, as the man who died with the mountain. And that was something I wrote. Just about that time. But there was another eruption. And M.L. Graham of Arch Cape wrote about it, remembering the Great Onion Peak eruption. The unexpected eruption of historically dormant Onion Peak on the Oregon coast near Arch Cape is still talked about many, many years later. For those who lived through it, not only was the eruption catastrophic, it was also baffling. Onion Peak is not hollow like a normal volcano. Geologists are still unable to explain why it erupted. Onion Peak erupted in a superating blast of blue gas and steam that sent kitchen-like odors into the atmosphere. No one was injured, although almost everyone in the area later reported stinging tears in their eyes immediately after the blast. Residents who were outside complained of being hit by moist, stringy debris that resembled sauerkraut. Emergency crews were sent into the area, and the mountain was put under martial law. Evacuation of residents to the old lighthouse at Tillamook Rock, which is currently a columbarium for wealthy ashes, was attempted in a fleet of surplus rubber dinghies. Most refused to flee. "This is my home," one said in tears. "I can't leave it like this." He pointed to a house that was almost buried under the stringy sauerkraut substance. A creamy lava, which had the color and consistency of Roquefort, dripped from the roof. The closest person to Onion Peak when it erupted was the botanist Gunther Leake, who became famous as the man who raced a volcano. He was camped at the mountain's base and reported that it emitted a rotting vegetable odor just before it blew. He has provided the following account of his race with death for this anniversary commemoration of what has become known as the Great Onion Peak Eruption. "I was camped at the base of Onion Peak," Leake said, "to study the effects of the cucumber beetle has on tansy ragwort. I heard a deep rumble that sounded like the growl of an upset stomach. It was followed by a jolting earth tremor. Then there was a flash and a blast of blue gas and steam that blinded me with tears and sent me reeling. A powerful stench that I thought smelled like my wife's compost heap made it almost impossible to breathe. I was thrown about by another series of tremors, which were followed by a deafening sound that I swear was a cosmic belch. I abandoned my camp in an instant and fled down a logging trail. I could hear more loud belches behind me. I looked back and saw an ooze pour out of the steaming peak and down the slopes toward me. I started running again as the creamy lava buried most of the mountain's flowers and trees. I felt that I was being chased by a salad dressing. After a while, I got winded and ducked behind an old cedar tree and looked up at the mountain. It was peeling away in front of my eyes. Most of its top lay in the valley in large, round slices. Great hissing geysers erupted all around me, and soon the air was spicy with garlic and vinegar smells. I began to run again, barely ahead of the lava that covered the forest, as if it were a huge salad. When I finally reached the nearby community of Arch Cape, emergency operations were already underway. I noticed that everybody was crying. A fleet of traffic watch helicopters brought in an army of reporters and photographers who interviewed the weeping populace. One of the helicopters gave me a last look at Onion Peak. Its once majestic bulb had peeled away and left a raw suppuration in its place. The lava had flowed into Liver Lake and thickened it to the consistency of pan gravy. And that was the statement of Gunther Leake. Later, it was thought that damage might have been minimized if aerial tankers had been used to drop baking soda on the erupting mountain. A vacationing chef was heard to say that the volcanic ash tasted rather like an exquisite court bouillon au la creque. Onion Peak has remained quiet for the past several years, and geologists suspect that the eruption was one of nature's rare and inexplicable phenomena. The timber industry has attempted to spray the area with disinfectants, but a group that calls itself 165 Friends of the Scallion has stymied its plans with court suits. The group would like to make Onion Peak a national historical site. Since the eruption, residents say that sometimes when the wind tilts from the east and blows off Onion Peak, they can smell something spoiling. And that was by Michael Graham, remembering the great Onion Peak eruption. And he lives and writes in Arch Cape in the shadow of Onion Peak. And he has retired as fire marshal for Cannon Beach. He was, for at least 30 years, a member of the Volunteer Fire Department of Cannon Beach and Arch Cape, and was an assistant chief. And one might say, one of my comrades when I was a volunteer fireman for Cannon Beach many, many years ago. Well, this is a very squally day here in the Pacific Northwest, at least this part of it, in the Columbia River area. I managed to get here in between squalls. I left my house walking just as the rain ceased and got here just before rain and hail once again hit us. A beautiful, gorgeous sky that I stared at while walking. Well, this has been Michael McCusker. I just might be here next Thursday if the sky doesn't fall and a truck doesn't hit me.